right field, and he dives! He's got it! Hunter Pence robbing Amarista of a hit.
Hello, baseball fans, and welcome to A Podcast to Be Named Later. I am your host, Chris Mitchell. We are in the third week of the baseball season, and there's been a lot going on, lots to talk about, and we're going to do the best we can to talk about as much of it as possible today. I'm going to have a fantastic guest on today from Fangraphs.com, Eno Saris. I like to call him the pitching guru because it seems like every time I follow him on Twitter or anytime I see him talking about things, it's always pitching, pitching, pitching. And I love pitching. To me, that's what I like best about pitching. I love nasty curveballs and batters made to look stupid. And Eno does as good a job as anyone out there when it comes to analyzing pitching and looking at specific types of pitches and how they break and how much they break and velocity. So we're going to definitely be talking about some pitching today. We're also going to be talking about exit velocity. Now, that obviously is to do with hitters, but Eno's working on some stuff when it comes to exit velocity. And we've been hearing about this over the last few years. I've heard that the Cardinals, for example, really value that when it comes to talking about their prospects and who they like to draft and things like that. So it's becoming much more of a, with StatCast and Major League Baseball Network focusing on Mike Trout hitting a home run over 113 miles per hour off the exit velocity. It looks nice. You put some high number against something like 99 miles per hour for a pitch. It is intriguing. It brings some interest and, but it also must have relevance. It's got to be relevant. If one guy hits it out with a 70-mile-per-hour exit velocity, another does it at 99, that's got to mean something. And consistency of it, how often someone does it, I would have to assume that that matters too. So we're going to talk about that. Eno's working on something with Fangraphs for that, and we're going to get into it today. Again, like I said, I want to talk about pitching. It's an early sample size. We've only got three or four starts out there. Jake Arrieta already throwing a no-hitter early in this season. But I do want to talk with him about pitching. Is the sample size relevant yet? You look at Max Scherzer. You look at some of these other guys. David Price really struggling in Boston. Granted, he's not a guy who necessarily pitches all that well in April. He's pitching in Fenway Park. He's pitching against the AL East. Those are not easy things to overcome for a pitcher. But David Price has done that his entire career. He pitched for Tampa Bay. He pitched for Toronto. He pitched a few games against American League East when he pitched for the Tigers. So that's not really an excuse. Maybe it's a mitigating factor, but nonetheless, it is a small sample size. So we'll get a little bit into pitching. The sample size, when can we trust it? And even if it's a small sample size, there are still reasons why you might be concerned, even if it is a small sample size. Adam Wainwright over there with the Cardinals, it seems like there's a lot of reason to be concerned there, but maybe not. I'm going to ask Eno Saris that. And then we're going to talk a little bit about some players in focus. Jose Altuve, he's going to be part of the discussion when it comes to exit velocity. But we're also going to talk about just how good he is. And like I said, with pitchers and breaking balls, I do want to ask Eno Saris about Rich Hill. He's a guy that I've been a big fan of ever since he was a Cub. In fantasy leagues, I traded him because I knew he was going to come back down to earth. But nonetheless, anybody that can throw a curveball like he does intrigues me, especially when they're left-handers. I don't know if it's a fetish, but I love left-handed pitchers and I love curveballs. And so we're going to get into a little bit about that. And if we have time, we've only got about 30 minutes here. We're going to go to Eno right now. But we're going to try to do what we can as far as breaking down the division races in the National League. What's Eno's opinion of the East, the Central, and the West? I'll throw out some of my thoughts and see if he can tell me that I'm wrong, which is pretty common. So we'll get into that as well. But right now we're talking with Eno Saris from Fangraphs. He's also a man with a plan when it comes to beer. We'll talk about that a little bit because he's got that to promote. He is a beer man. He is doing putting together some things for Craft Beer Lover's Guide to Baseball, and we'll get into that as well. But Eno, thanks a lot for coming on today. Are you sober now? Have you been drinking beer already, or is it a little too early for
you? I'm on the West Coast. I'm headed into the ballpark, so yeah, I'm soaked.
In foreign countries, they drink beer all day long, and I've even had an employee or two who wasn't afraid to drink a beer over lunch. So if you are drinking, maybe you shouldn't admit it, but I don't have a problem with it. We over here don't judge. And to be honest, one of my first jobs was as an assistant on a talk radio show in Boston, and the host used to make martinis for all of the guests. He almost made them drink them because he wanted them a little bit lubed up in order to have an interesting interview.
I'll try that with my next ball player.
Let's get into a little bit here. Before we get into exit velocity, and I do want to talk about what you're working on and get into that, but just real quickly, we haven't talked yet. We're about 3 weeks into the season. What's your thoughts or impressions on what are the stories so far through 3 weeks? What are the most noteworthy occurrences that we've seen so far?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think that every season necessarily has a story like this. I think last year we had the story of the youth being served and how great all those call-ups were. And I think that we kind of, you know, emptied the cupboards a little bit. So, we got Blake Snell coming up this weekend. He's a big prospect for the Rays, got a big arm. But I don't think it's the same thing as last year when, you know, the Cubs seemingly broke out like 8 rookies in one season. And there was just rookie after rookie after rookie. So I'm not sure that I have seen anything that's on the same level. Everyone's throwing harder. The velocity increase has continued. And I've noticed that people are throwing sliders harder. So there's something in between a cutter and a slider. There's kind of a new breaking ball that's out there right now. So, there's little things. I wouldn't say that there's as big a big trend line like last year with the rookies.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I don't know how much you follow prospects, but there's an inordinate amount of shortstops at the top 30 or 40 or 50 prospects in all of baseball. And while it's nice to see athletic, talented shortstops coming through the system because we don't see a ton of them at the major league level, I think part of it is probably like what you kind of said. They're already here. They rushed them last year. I mentioned this in one of my articles a couple of weeks ago over at rotoexperts.com, is that this class would look a lot nicer if Miguel Sano still had rookie eligibility or things like that. There are some guys like that had too many at-bats and no longer would be considered prospects or rookies that would have made this class a lot better if they were starting the season rather than spent, 250 or 300 bats like they did last year, Mikel Franco being another example.
Yeah, there's still youth to be excited about. And, you know, the game is still shifting towards youth. I mean, there's more and more production coming from guys that are under 26. And without the help of, certain enhancers, careers are ending earlier. So, I think if there is something to be learned for fantasy, I think the idea is that you have to get a little bit more worried about a guy earlier now. Now 30 is an interesting time. Like, if you look at Carlos Gomez, and, he's going to come up later when we talk about exit velocity, but, he's just turning 30, seems like a young guy, but, there's a lot of markers there that are going the wrong direction. Guys that are, starting to slow down at 33 now. Some of us remember the days when people were hitting, 60 and 70 jacks when they were 38 years old. So, okay. We have to realign our expectations of veterans a little bit, I think.
I want to ask you about the other side of that coin, which is, I hear this a lot. A lot of times if a prospect doesn't develop quite as quickly as you would like, some people are willing to give up on them faster, and I think I'm probably one of those. I don't give up, but I readjust my evaluations. But one of the excuses that people seem to make is that, he's still young. When I see a guy not quite performing like maybe the star he was supposed to, or even a full-time player like he's supposed to, people still say, he's only 23 or he's only 24. Is 23 or 24 really what you would consider young now? To me, when you see these guys, it seems like a lot of them are promoted by 21, 22. So by 24, if you're not seeing what you expected, is it still too early to reevaluate, or is the league really getting that much younger? I'm kind of curious because I get differing opinions from people I talk to.
Well, I've done some research into, peak age, doing aging curves and looking at different things. And I think baseball is really interesting because there are sort of two really important things going on. One is your athleticism, your body, and the other is your mind and learning the game, learning what people are trying to do to you. People talk about confidence, that sort of thing, just learning the mental aspect of the game. And, apologies to Yogi Berra, who used to say, this game is, I forget the quote about, 2% physical and 100% mental or something. I think that they're sort of equal things. You need to be physically able and you need to also learn the game. And I think that if you look at fields that are more on the athletic part, let's say guys like velocity, look at velocity. It peaks when you get into the league and then it just goes down. I mean, velocity goes down every year you're in the league. There is no gaining velocity. It's just down, 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 down. So, I think power, on the other hand, if you could look at sort of raw power on the other side, that peaks earlier than people think. That peaks around 25. So now, to answer your question, if you're looking at a young pitcher who's 23, 24 and struggling, well, you know his velocity is only going to get worse. So he would have to learn other pitches, you know, refine something, you know, have a whole new approach or something. So you do want to see some success early on. And then on the hitting side, you know, he can learn what pitches to swing at and, you know, try to go oppo or try to pull more and try to do stuff like that. But, you know, if you give them enough samples, if you give them a full year and they don't really develop that power, it's sort of rare to then develop the power later on. We, you know, we'll remember the stories about guys who do develop power later on, but it's rare to develop power after you turn 25 or 26.
It's interesting you say that about the velocity, that it declines right away. What is the typical – because when I do a lot of prospect reading and I do a lot of studying and trying to evaluate prospects, and of course you like to see that a prospect can get it up to 70, 97, 98. Of course, nobody averages that or sits at that in any consistent amount of innings in a row or anything like that. But it's nice to see that someone throws 97, 98 and that he sits 92, 93 or something like that, or 94, 95. But – you hear about radar guns and maybe they're a little juiced and things like this. What is the typical velocity for a hard thrower? You know, a starter who goes six innings and he holds the velocity for at least a good portion of it. What is the typical velocity? Because I think we think if you don't throw over 95, you don't throw hard. But I suspect that actually the harder throwers don't consistently throw over 95 all that much. Is my guess wrong, or what is the typical velocity for a starter that throws hard? And what, I mean, are there a lot of guys out there throwing under 90 consistently, and we just think that everyone throws over 90?
Yeah, it's a little different. You have to kind of separate lefties and righties, because there's fewer lefties, and they, since there's fewer of them, teams will use a crappier one. You know what I'm saying? Like, because the sample is smaller, so you don't get as many guys at the top end, and everything sort of shifted. So basically, you know, I've run this where it's the average for lefties and righties in terms of movement and velocity. The average four-seamer from a lefty is 91, and the average four-seamer from a righty is 92. So basically, you know, anytime you're talking lefties and righties, you take a mile off. So if you see a lefty throwing 90, 91, he's doing okay. But if you see a righty throwing 90-91, he's below average. So that's gone up a little bit, and it does include relievers. So it's a little bit different for starters. But basically, you know, you want to have over 91 for a righty starter, and you want to be over 90 for a lefty starter. And you know, good velocity, there's very few people that average over 94. There's probably five of them. So, you know, that's, you know, good velocity is still 92, 93. You know, let me do a quick leaderboard here on Fangraphs for fastball velocity. And what you get, of course, is Noah Syndergaard number one at 97. And then you get Eovaldi, Richards, Martinez, Severino, Ventura, Jose Fernandez. Those are the only guys who average over 95. Clear of 95, and then there's 15 guys that average over 94. So that's plus velocity, and all those guys are guys that we all love. I mean, you know, other than Severino, everybody is ripping up the league right now. So velocity is important. Every little tick counts.
Yeah, chicks dig the long ball, but fantasy players and you and I dig the velocity. I think that's the rule of thumb, and of course that hopefully results in strikeouts, and usually it does. Let me ask you this, and I'm asking kind of a nuanced question here, and we will get to exit velocity and things like that here in a moment. We're talking with Eno Saris from Fangraphs. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at Eno Saris. I highly recommend that you do, and also, of course, head on over to Fangraphs.com. But when you say that they average that, how often does a Noah Syndergaard throw 95-plus throughout a game? Is it 50% of his pitches? Is it 75? I mean, how often do guys throw up at towards the peak of their velocity, and how often do they sit at a more comfortable level? I mean, you hear about max effort. I would assume most guys don't throw at max effort, or obviously they wouldn't be able to go as many innings. How often does Syndergaard throw 95? Are you going to get how many pitches is that? I don't want to, I guess, a pitch count, but how consistently are those high guys throwing at that kind of velocity, and how often are they just being more cautious and throwing at a lower level and just getting by?
Yeah, I did the numbers I quoted there for the top guys. So Syndergaard's 97.7. That's his average. So he's actually, if you watch the game of his recently, he's hitting triple digits in games. And usually back max velocity is, another two ticks or so above what they're sitting at. And, it is an interesting thing to discuss because I for a couple of reasons. One is some guys that you take out of the rotation and put in the bullpen gain, a half a tick or something. And then there's some guys like Liam Hendricks that go from 91 to 96. And I think that's probably related to their max velocity. And I think that probably the relationship between max velocity and what you sit at is different for every player. So I think this is definitely something that can be studied more. And then the other thing is, you remember Verlander in the day, back in the day, used to sit in 93, 94, but then even in the sixth or seventh inning, he'd be able to ramp it up to 98 when he always had it in the tank. Now he's at 91. The max is 93, and that's important. Another thing to think about with velocity, 94 miles an hour is a magic number. So if you can average 94 like Shelby Miller did last year, then fastballs that are above 94 give up fewer home runs and get more swing strikes. It's a big jump there at 94. So Shelby Miller, when he was in Atlanta, was averaging 94 and was not giving up home runs. Now he's averaging 92, and only a few of his fastballs go over 94, and he's having the home run problem. So, these things are all related, and every little tick counts, but 94 is a big magic number, and on the other side, around 87 is the magic number. Between 88 and 93, there's smaller effects.
It's interesting that there's an actual line in the sand where that happens, that you can actually pinpoint it, but the numbers must be pretty drastic. Is there any explanation for why that number is, or have you ever heard any scientific explanation as to why 94 somehow is the number? That's interesting.
I think it probably has to do with reaction times. There's only a certain, for example, the hitter doesn't even see the last, 5 to 7 feet. the last time he can physically, like the brain, the signal can go to his eyes and to his hands. That whole group of nerves can fire. The fastest they can fire and he can react to anything is about 8 feet or 10 feet out. So he doesn't even know what's happening with the ball. That's all extrapolation. So, if it's 94 versus 93, maybe right there, maybe that period of time more happens, or maybe the ball gets there quicker and it's just everything's harder for the brain to deal with. So I think it has to do with, neurochemistry, really. And that's why we see all these teams, trying to ramp up velocity. I was just at Driveline Baseball in Seattle, and they work on with weighted balls and stuff just to up velocity, and that's their main goal. And all their guys come out there pumping, mid-90s to high 90s. So they had a guy up there, Casey Weathers, threw 108 the other day. So,
wow.
This is, if you want a trend, this is a trend, but it's been a trend for a little bit.
Yeah, I think a couple of years ago, one of the speculations people were doing was with all this additional velocity and all these people throwing harder, that's explaining why we're seeing more Tommy John surgeries. I don't know if that's even remotely close, but I remember everyone was just assuming there's a lot more velocity out there, which of course the numbers confirm it, but they were then taking it that one step further and blaming Tommy John on velocity. Do you buy into that at all? Is velocity causing more injuries?
Yeah, there's a higher risk. There's a higher risk at the higher velocities. It's true. And that may be the one thing that we can escape. There are a lot of things that baseball is trying to do and trying to go down into, high schools and colleges and trying to help, with best practices and this and that and clean up mechanics. And there's a lot of stuff that we're trying to do right now to cut down on these. On these surgeries, but when you're throwing 98 miles an hour, Noah Syndergaard has already had a couple bouts of forearm tightness, and it's because how hard he throws. I mean, he's throwing 98 miles an hour on average. That means, he's pumping up 100 miles. And then if you think about Nathan Eovaldi, he throws a split finger. I wrote a whole article about whether or not a split finger, has more health risk to it. And the problem is that we don't have a huge sample with it because there's not a ton of people throwing it. And so we can't say definitively. But there was enough scientific, medical, mechanical, you know, smoke there to consider the fact that maybe the split finger is riskier. Now, Nathan Eovaldi's throwing the split finger 40% of the time. It's part of why he's striking out everybody. He's throwing a straight as heck 98-mile-an-hour fastball, but then he's pairing it every other pitch is a split finger, which looks like the fastball coming out and then drops down, you know, a fair amount. So that's why Eovaldi's doing great. But at the same time, you have to remember, Eovaldi sat with an elbow issue last year. And it might be related to not only his high velocity, but also the number of splitters he's throwing. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. It's really hard to really prognosticate on this for fantasy reasons. And so I think the one thing that I sort of glom onto for fantasy is if the guy was hurt last year, he's more likely to be hurt next year. So that's the one thing we know for sure. So, you know, if you want to try and, you know, avoid guys who were hurt last year, that's a good plan.
Yeah, I think so. We're talking with Eno Saris from Fangraphs. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at Eno Saris. You're working on, you were mentioning that you're working on an article and some studies here on exit velocity. Real quickly, tell us about exit velocity and how reliable is it, and then we'll get into how predictive it can be and things like that. But explain what exit velocity is and how it's become relevant in baseball.
You know, it's getting more and more reliable every day, and it's just the velocity in miles per hour, the ball off the bat. And, you know, last year was the first year that we really got any taste of it and StatCast anything on it. And I think they've cleaned it up a little bit. We didn't used to get launch angle, which is sort of the angle off the bat. We didn't used to get that last year for every ball, but now we get it for every ball. So now we're able to say things like who hits a ton of balls in the ideal launch angle for home runs. And, you know, a surprising name in there was Matt Duffy. He actually hits a high percentage of his balls in the ideal launch angle for home runs. So that's an interesting finding. And on the exit velocity side, we can find that the velocity coming off the bat, it's important to note what the angle is, but just velocity off the bat, so just how hard they're hitting the ball, that becomes meaningful in 40 balls in play, which is basically what everyone's at right now. So basically, even though we've only played 3 weeks of the season, we can still say something about who's hitting the ball harder this year than last year. So I just did a leaderboard, and Altuve is number one. He's hitting the ball 8 miles an hour harder than he hit it last year. And last year was his power peak. So, you know, I believe in this early power explosion from him. I think he's going to hit another 15 homers. I think he's going to have 20 homers for the year, a new career high. And that all comes from the fact that he's hitting the ball harder, and I looked at his launch angle. He's hitting it higher in the air, too. So, other interesting names with Scooter Jeanette, who, you know, he's out there on wires and, you know, people are trying to decide if they can believe what he's doing. I think he can have a Joe Panic type season. He's that kind of player. Cole Calhoun is a number five, and he's upped his velocity five miles an hour. So there's a guy with a hot start that you can believe in, I think. Mike Moustakas is on this leaderboard. And then my favorite one, because he's done so many things right, Yasmani Tomas has upped his exit velocity 4 miles an hour. He's changed his body type. I mean, he's not going to ever be skinny, but he's not the same guy, chunky guy that he was early last year. And he's changed his launch angle. He's hitting the ball in the air more. He's swinging less. Swing percentage is another thing you can look at in small samples because you're looking at per pitch stat. So, you know, instead of looking at ABs right now, which, you know, they've only had 30, 40, 50, you can look at per pitch, which they've seen 150, 200 pitches. So, anyway, he's really done everything that you could ask of him. Swing less, swing at better pitches, you know, not reaching as much, hit the ball in the air more, and hit the ball harder. And look and change your body type. When I saw him in spring training last year, I saw a guy who had no idea what a breaking ball was, or didn't, you know, couldn't recognize it at all. You know, his butt fell out every pitch. He was just, it was all arms, no legs. He just looked terrible. He didn't even look like a major leaguer. And I thought, this guy's gonna be a bust. I want zero shares of him. You know, he just came to town last week, and I saw him in San Francisco, and I said, this is not even the same guy. So, you know, exit velocity can help you on levels like this.
Yeah, and he started a little bit slow this year, but he's really getting it together in the last week or 10 days. I've noticed, I think I cut him about 8 or 9 days ago, and he's had like 3 home runs since. So I'm like, geez, I don't know what I was missing, but I got to go back out there and get him. Yasmani Tomas is definitely an intriguing guy. I would have to assume, first, when it comes to exit velocity, how much sample size do we need? I mean, if I wanted to try to play devil's advocate with it, I could say, well, he faced weaker pitchers, or he hit a lot of really hard balls when pitch counts were higher, or, you know, I could try to make those arguments. Whether they would be accurate or convincing is another story. But how much of a sample size do you want to see before you say, okay, this exit velocity matches the increase or the improvement? Is a small sample size okay, or do you need a large sample size specifically? Because I want to get into logic, because I actually think a small sample size is plenty for that, because if you hit from a common launch angle all the time, then that's where you hit from all the time. So I can see how a small sample size would not be a concern there. But with exit velocity, do you need a large sample size, or is it just he's just making better contact and a small sample size is plenty?
You want 50 balls in play, and everyone's right now it's sort of 40 to 45. So it's a little bit small, but, you know, the reliability isn't something that happens magically in one moment. So basically, since we have 40 balls in play out of 50, you know, it's very close. It's closer than a lot of other stats. You know, you would never look at a home run total now, or even something as nice as isolated power. You wouldn't look at that now because that takes 3 to 4 months to stabilize. We're like a week away from this being stable. And when I say stable, it means that if you just took his exit velocity now and then, you know, correlated it to his future exit velocity, which hasn't happened yet, but if you just took what he has now and correlated it to his future velocity, you would get, you would do better than just using league average. So, you know, what he's doing now has become more meaningful than what the league is doing. So that does mean there can be fluctuations. Like, I looked at the bottom of the list, and the guys, you know, yesterday when I ran this, the guys that had lost the most exit velocity were Todd Frazier, Brandon Belt, Marcelo Zuna, Ian Desmond, and Mike Trout. Well, 4 of those guys hit home runs last night. I don't even know which ones. I think Trout, Ozuna, and Frazier. And Desmond, yeah. So those 4 of those guys hit the home runs last night. I reran the list. It's all the same, really, except Carlos Gomez has pushed. I think Ozuna is now 6th, and Carlos Gomez is in the bottom 5. So, you know, 100-mile-an-hour home run doesn't actually move the needle so much that a guy falls in or falls out. You know, that's why 50 balls in play is decent. You know, 100, because everything's really 80, 90 miles an hour. So 100 does add a little bit, but it doesn't shift the whole needle. So, I think that it's something we should be looking at right now. It's decent in small samples.
How many balls do the typical batters put into play? And granted, we have a lot of home runs, walks, or strikeout guys, so maybe this era is not the greatest time to be talking about how many balls are put in play, but Jose Altuve seems to hit everything. So how many balls do a typical player put into play every single year? Because 50 balls in play seems like a very small sample size. It seems like as you get into August that maybe getting tired from the season, or just pitchers catching up to you, or whatever it may be, it just seems to me 50 is a small sample size, but you're saying that it's actually plenty.
It's about 10%. I mean, it's 500 for the season. I mean, it is a small amount. But there's something about, you know, just think about, you know, all these things can change. The pitch coming in, the sequencing, the park you're in, all that stuff can change day to day, you know, and can be meaningful to what happens to the ball once it's in play. But you don't see guys tinkering or changing their swing drastically in the season. It'll happen season to season, where they go home and they say, you know what, Steven Piscotty, I want to hit the ball in the air more. Jake Lamb did it this off season. I want to change my swing. I want to hit the ball in the air more. I want to do this. So they go and they change their swing. Once they come back, though, during the season, they want to put the same swing on the ball every time. And if you're putting the same swing on the ball, your bat speed is going to be about the same, because you're not doing a lot of, like, you're not able to do a lot of working out in the same way that you can do in the off season. So your bat speed remains the same. and your launch angle is going to be about the same because you're coming at the ball the same way. You know, your swing isn't going to change much. So I think exit velocity and launch angle are a way to talk about a guy's swing without sort of independent of results. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I think, exit velocity is a good thing to look at right now.
Are you concerned about Mike Trout? The velocity's down. He's having a little bit of a slow start, but everyone says it's Mike Trout. He's the next Mickey Mantle. It's a small sample size. He'll be fine. But does the exit velocity make you concerned? And if you are a Trout owner, are you selling? Are you selling, basing it almost or mostly on exit velocity?
I don't think he's going to hit 40 home runs this year. And I don't know if that means that his true talent isn't at 40 home runs and last year was just sort of a peak year type thing. But, you know, you've also noticed that he's stealing fewer and fewer bases every year. And what I was talking about with, like, athleticism versus learned skill, like, I know he's only 24 and he shouldn't be falling off athletically. But if you low, like, sprinting is like, the competitive world of sprinting, those guys fall off really quickly. You know, those guys, you know, in terms of just pure speed, that falls off into your, you know, mid-20s and late-20s. The best guys in the world are 23, 24, 25, you know. Possible that he's either hurting, and maybe in that case he can fix it and you know, and be better on the other side, or that he's just not as quite as athletic as he was, you know, even just a year or two ago. So I sold a few shares of him in leagues where he was a keeper league and his price was getting more and more expensive and he was already basically one of the most expensive players in the league. I sold him last year just because I thought this is a great time to sell him. Everyone says he's consensus best player in the league and, you know, he's not stealing the same bases as he was stealing before and I can get a horde of prospects and my team was no good. And so I've already sold a couple shares of Mike Trout. And going forward, I don't know. I think Bryce Harper has usurped him as the best hitter in baseball.
Yeah, I made the argument in a blog that I actually just finished before the show where I argue that I think Jose Altuve is going to be the better player this year, especially in points leagues. But in normal leagues, when you combine the fact that Trout isn't stealing as much and Altuve may steal 35 or 40 bases again, if Tuve, I think like you were kind of suggesting, Altuve might get to 20 home runs this year, which he hit about 15 last year. If he's on pace to do better than he did last year this season. So if he hits 20 homers and steals 40 bases and hits possibly for a batting title or at least 310, he hit 311 last year, you could definitely argue that he was drafted around 11th or 12th overall. But you could argue if you were drafting today, I think most people would take Bryce Harper number one, and I wouldn't argue for Altuve over him maybe. But I think you could argue that you'd rather have Altuve over Trout. I think there's a pretty good argument to be made there. Is that an argument you'd make?
Yeah, you know, once you add in the position, because just, you know, homers and steals are almost as valuable as each other. So a lot of times I just add those up just to help, you know, help compare guys who are more power speed versus speed power, you know. And you're talking about a guy who's going to have 60 homers plus steals. I really doubt that Trout's going to make that number. He didn't make it last year, you know, and last year was a great year. And this year he's going to hit fewer homers, and I don't see what the argument is. I know Trout said he wanted to steal more bases, but he's not taking off as much. And he already got caught one. So I think that, you know, the most likely outcome is like a 290, you know, 30, 35, maybe 33 homers and 10 stolen bases. That's nice. But, you know, if Altuve goes 290, 20, 40, that's better. And second base. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing for sure.
When it comes to, we're talking with Eno Saris from Fangraphs. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at Eno Saris. We got to let him go here. We just got a couple more quick questions, and then we'll get him out of here. When I look at a batter, and I'm trying to just determine whether they're in decline, for example, I just went off on Pablo Sandoval, not this year, but last year, because I just couldn't believe the Red Sox signed him, knowing that he had declined in every meaningful category for three straight years. That tells me that he's on decline. I don't know what the Red Sox were reading. Maybe they had typos in the numbers. But I look at that and say, okay, the batting average is down, the on-base percentage is down, then you look at OPS and things like that, and when those are down, to me, that tells you that he's in decline. Like you said, exit velocity is a relatively new stat that we're looking at, but when you're looking at it, do you expect to be able to predict a decline or an improvement based on year-to-year, or is exit velocity something that one year could be bad, the next year could be good? Is it going to be reliable on predicting both regression but also improvement?
You know, the year-to-year thing is hard because we only have 2 years. And so, you know, and like I said, people can go home and change their swing in the off season. So I'll have to sort of, you know, tap out on that one. I don't know. We need more data. It's like we're at the beginning of PitchFX right now, and everything that we know from PitchFX, we only know because we've had PitchFX since 2007. So we've had it almost 10 years, and it's taken us a while to even get to know what we know now. So, you know, some of this stuff is going to take some time to really nail down. But the one thing I am using it for is to say, you know, okay, Yasmani Tomas looks like he's breaking out. I have this idea of him as being bad. Oh, look at this. His exit velocity is up. Maybe I should reconsider the idea I have of John Segura, or Gene Segura. You know, he's a guy who's been terrible for 2 years. He's added 4 miles an hour, and he's swinging less. And reaching less, you know, and he has a swing change. Now I've seen these are all things that are meaningful in small samples. I can say, you know what, I think Figueroa is going to be better than his projections. I think he's going to have a good year this year. So that's how comfortable I am using it. I'm not, I will need this year to finish and then to be able to sort of compare guys year to year over the last 2 years to really know how much I'm going to use in the off season. There are different stats. There are stats that are better in the off season and stats that are better during the season. For example, for pitching, one of the two best stats to use in small samples, one is velocity, just because we know velocity is good. Velocity being down could be an injury. And the other is strikeouts minus walks, because it just takes away, it strips everything away. And it just says how many strikeouts, how many guys are striking out, how many guys are walking. These are the very simplest way we can look at a guy. That's actually the best in-season predictor, past Sierra or FIP or XFIP or all those alphabet soup things. The best in-season indicator is strikeouts minus walks. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily hold true season to season, but it is true in-season.
And it seems to me like exit velocity would be a great one in-season. That's why I asked it. And, of course, like you said, we don't have a sample size to really be predictive. But it does seem like it could be a stat that you could look to determine if a guy is for real this season. You know, Trevor Story is the big story in baseball. Can he continue to do this? Did he have this potential? Why didn't we know that this guy was out there to be this potentially this good? It seems like exit velocity along with launch angle could be very predictive. But year to year, you gotta wonder. I mean, I would assume that as a guy gets older and his physical abilities decline, then you would see a consistent exit velocity drop. But while a guy's in his peak 5 or 6 year period, I would think that it may not be predictive as far as predicting the next season, but it would be predictive in season. I know you got to let you go, but I want to ask you a couple quick pitching questions. We were talking about sample size a lot in all of this stuff. Do we have enough of a pitching sample size now to be able to come away with any conclusions about anything? Or if not, when do you start to look and say, okay, sample size is no longer an excuse for why a guy is struggling?
I think, pitchers are very interesting because they give you these big bursts of information, and then they go away for 5 days. And it just seems like everyone freaks out, you know, between those 5 days. They're like, oh, my God, do I have to worry about Jacob deGrom? Well, you know, we have to wait a little bit longer because we have to wait for him to come back, you know? And, you know, but there's always like the, oh, and then finally, okay, he had a good start. Okay, everything's fine. So it's like Zach Greinke had those first two bad starts. I tried to look, and the things I look at in small samples are his pitches the same velocity? Are they moving the same? And is he using them the same? People can manage that pretty easily. Go on Brooks Baseball, go on Fangraphs. Just look at the movement numbers. It's harder to then say, okay, there is a difference in movement. Is it good or bad? But if you can see that their performance has been bad and there's a big difference in movement, big difference in pitch selection, they stop throwing a pitch either because it's hurting their arm or they don't like it or people have been hammering it. You know, all those things, I think, you know, and then if there's a guy who, like Brandon Finnegan, we all didn't know if he had a changeup. Well, then he threw 7 straight changeups in one start. And if you look at just his pitch selection, you just use that as a proxy for how many pitches he has, it looks like he has an actual changeup. So, you know, that changes what we think about Brandon Finnegan, makes it much more likely to be a starter this year and to be a relevant guy. So, you know, I look a lot at pitching mix, velocities, and then a little bit of movement, too. And I couldn't see anything in Greinke's stuff that was too worrisome. So I thought Greinke was fine. But if I look at a guy like Madison Bumgarner, you know, his velocity is down. His velocity is down 2 ticks from last year, really. And it hasn't been back up. His release point was all over the place, and he got that back on track a little bit. and he's had some better starts since the first two, but his velocity has not gone back up to where it was before. I do not think he's going to have the same season that he had last year.
That was actually going to be one of my next questions is, even though it's a small sample size, are there some pitchers like Matt Harvey doesn't look the same? Chris Archer, I just thought that Chris Archer, without getting into the specifics. Sorry about that. I got a phone ringing over here under my ear. I'm listening to you and the other. Without getting into the specifics of Chris Archer, I just assumed that because I follow advanced metrics, but nowhere near where you do. I'm more of a touch and feel kind of an analyst. And while I expected Chris Archer to be good this year, he's a good pitcher. He's always been a good pitcher. I just thought his improvement last year was well above what I would have ever expected from him, even though I thought he was an underappreciated pitcher before last season. So I thought he was going to regress. But now we hear a lot of people talking about how his slider, he's not throwing it as effectively. He's not getting ahead in counts and things like that. What pitchers out there right now, you mentioned that you are concerned about Bumgarner. Are you concerned about Harvey? Are you concerned about Archer? It seems like you're not concerned about Greinke. Are there a couple of these pitchers out here that normally we would consider studs, and even though it's a small sample size, you are concerned about what they're going to do this year?
You know, I'm not actually super concerned about Matt Harvey and Chris Archer, and the main reason is that I can't find anything that tells me that I need to be really concerned. I mean, I guess Harvey's velocity is down a little, but he's still a velocity leader. I mean, he's still up at 94, 95 miles an hour. And, you know, Chris Archer's velocity is down for one start, but then it's back to where it is. The release points are about the same. There's a little bit of smoke there, but it's not – for me, you know, there was like almost fire with Bumgarner because he was self-reporting pain. He talked about a pain in his foot and pain in his ribs. His release point was all over the place. You know, nobody's swinging his curveball right now. I don't know why. And there's all these things going on. With Harvey, it's like, you know, the slider isn't quite as good, but I don't know why. He hasn't been getting the strikeouts, but there's not a real big change in movements and velocity on his pitches. So Archer is somewhat similar. So I actually think those guys, I'm not ready to, you know, I would love to have one game with some strikeouts for the two of them, but, you know, I'm not selling those guys low for sure. But, you know, Shelby Miller's stuff is all over the place. And his mechanics are so off that he's hitting the mound with his hand when he's pitching. So, you know, I think that Shelby Miller is getting close to a drop because, honestly, you can't sell him. And there's all these young, new pitchers that are coming up that are super exciting that I think I'd almost rather have than Shelby Miller right now. So that's one guy that comes up for me.
It's interesting you mentioned Shelby Miller because he was dropped in one of my keeper leagues. It's a limited keeper league. So Shelby Miller isn't a keeper, but for him to be released outright in a keeper league, that it surprised me. I actually put in a waiver claim and it cost me. I had to go to the back of the line in the waiver wire, but I thought he was worth it. It wouldn't surprise me if he has a down season, but it did surprise me to see that he was outright released and that I won the waiver claim. I was like the eighth waiver wire person, and some people just don't pay attention. But it surprised me that not only was he released, but with the eighth waiver wire priority, I was able to get him. But now you say that he's actually potentially droppable. That's interesting because, again, I loved him as a prospect.
Yeah, no, one thing that's interesting is he's throwing a split finger now, and that gives him an actual changeup. So, you know, that might be able to overcome the fact that he's more 93 now than 94. So there is still, you know, with a mechanical change to get right, you know, there's still some upside there. He's still a guy who has above average velocity, a good curveball, and now a split finger that should be good if he can figure out how to use it. So, you know, there's still stuff to like. I would pick him up if he was free and, you know, in keeper leagues. Because then in keeper leagues, everything changes. You have more time to wait for a guy. You can put him on your bench and not necessarily need to play him every day, you know? So, you know, if I could pick him up and stash him, I might. And I would think that it might come together late in the season this year or maybe next season he figures it back out again. If you look at his career, he's gone, you know, up again, down again. So, you know, I do think he's a talented guy. But in terms of what's going to happen this season, I'm not sure it's a good time to go and get him or anything. I was never out on Arrieta or anything. I think DeGrom's command and the pitches he has can overcome some of the velocity dip. And I think that's probably true for Corey Kluber too. So, you know, these are guys that people are worried about. Felix Hernandez is really interesting because his velocity is all the way down to 89. And you'd think that he'd have more ramifications than he does. But his super changeup is so amazing that he just throws that thing over and over again. Nobody can do anything with it. And maybe he can survive at 89. I don't know. If he didn't have the swinging strikes that he has, I'd be more worried about him.
I have no idea how Jared Weaver is still in the league, and he's been throwing 86, 87 with lesser stuff than Felix for quite some time. So it is interesting. We're talking with Eno Saris from Fangraphs. Eno, glad to be able to talk some baseball with you today. Before you go, I always see you talking about beer on Twitter, and you claim you're sober now. I'll take your word for it. But I've got it in the back of my mind that if I need to bribe you, I just need to find a good beer, and I know a few up in Vermont that I can send you. So I've got my bribe already if I really need to. But you're taking on a project when it comes to beer. Why don't you tell people about it and let them know how they can kind of follow you when it comes to this? Because it sounds like an interesting project, and I think people are going to want to know about it.
Yeah, I'm writing what's called the craft beer. What is it? The guide to baseball for craft beer lovers. I got to get my name right. A craft beer lover's guide to baseball. That's it. A craft beer lover's guide to baseball. The point is that there are a lot of people who love beer and baseball and want to go to a park that they've never been to before. And they're like, I'm going to go down to Philly this year, or I'm going to go to Baltimore this year. And they want, you know, one-stop shopping. Where can I go get good beers around the stadium and in the stadium? So I basically built this thing that this book that is going to have locations near the stadium, locations around the stadium, and locations in the stadium where the best beer is to be had. And you could basically use this book to say, okay, I'm going to Philly. I'm going to check out these two breweries on the drive down. Then I'm going to hopefully park the car and leave it somewhere for a long time. and then check out these other breweries and make it to the game. So, you know, that it can help people sort of design a little mini vacation that has beer and baseball in it.
Now,
anyway, you can spot that and do some beer writing on beergraphs.com. So it's an offshoot of Fangraphs, but it's about beer.
Beergraphs.com, Eno Saris writing about beer, not about being drunk on beer, but about actually enjoying and appreciating beer. My brother will be very interested. He loves beer. He loves to invite me to go places because I'm not a big drinker, so that allows him to drink for the both of us. And he loves beer, so
he'll definitely
be. Yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised I'm not invited to more places. When people find out that I essentially don't drink, I'm surprised they don't just immediately invite me, especially anybody under about 45. He and his wife love when I'm around. I babysit their kids and I drive them around while they drink wine and beer, and so they at least appreciate me for that. But where is the best beer? If you've been around a lot of places and you've sampled a lot of beer, my parents went out on a trip to Europe and they've been to Germany. My brother likes to go to Oktoberfest as often as he can to go along with his love for beer. And so they talk about how much better the beer is in Germany than here, that it's not even close. But from America's perspective, where do you find the best beer and who has the best beer? My brother went to school in Vermont and there's a couple breweries there that they just love. Where, in your opinion, is the best beer in the United States?
You know, it used to be much more city-specific. Like, it used to be, you know, kind of like Vermont and San Diego. They were the best two places. But I think it's spread around a little bit, and I would say the two best places really are California in general, and I would say New England, because Massachusetts has Trillium and Treehouse. They're really good beers. And then those Vermont beers you're talking about, Mawson's, Fiddlehead, some of them escape me now, but, Alchemist, there's some great beers up there. And I think those sort of balance each other out. So, you know, California and New England are doing Houston has got a bit of a scene coming up, Houston and Austin, you know, so there's a little bit of stuff going on in Texas and then, you know, Portland and Oregon, in general, has a good beer scene. But if I had to pick two places to go visit, I would probably do something like San Diego or Boston. And Boston would just be kind of the landing point. I'd just do a bunch of driving around Boston. So those are my two favorite beer cities right now.
Or you'd bribe me to do the driving and you'd just carry the beers around.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite beer? Is there one that stands out before we let you go?
Treehouse Julius is you remember the Julius, the orange Julius that we used to have as kids?
Yep.
There's a beer now that kind of looks like that. It looks kind of like an orange Julius, and it kind of tastes like an orange Julius because it's a beer. So that's a fun beer that I'm having right now that I'm enjoying a lot.
Sounds good. Eno Saris from FanGraphs and also BeerGraphs.com. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at Eno Saris. Eno, thanks a lot for coming on today. Stay good, stay sober, drive safe, and enjoy the game today.
I will. I think they'll actually have one. I think the rain's stopping. But thanks for having me on.
All right, Eno, thanks a lot. I can't believe it actually rains in California. I didn't think that was the case. I thought they were in a drought out there. But all right, that's Eno Saris from FanGraphs. If you want to follow him on Twitter, I would highly recommend you do it, not only for his baseball knowledge, but also if you want to talk some beer or just see beer commentary, head on over to at Eno Saris. Or you can read his content over at fangraphs.com. Or like he said, if you want to go into beergraphs.com, he'll provide you with some beer intake, and you can read his blog from there. We've been talking about pitching and exit velocity here with Eno Saris from Fangraphs. Hopefully you enjoyed the program. If you'd like to be informed about our show or you want to follow us, you can always do that on Blog Talk Radio. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/Bosco Nation. That's where our podcast originates from. So if you want to be alerted to when the podcast will be airing, you can follow us on Blog Talk Radio. You can also follow us on Facebook. I have a page for the show. It's a podcast to be named later. Surprisingly, very creative. Not only the name of the podcast, but also the name of the Facebook group. You can head on over there. I post rundowns of the guests, as well as the topics, as well as obviously the times. And I include a link to the program. So if you want to just click on it, it pops up on your browser and you can listen to the program. You can listen to it live. Or you can just listen to it right there on your computers. You don't have to download anything. You just click on the link. It pops up in your browser as one of your tabs, and boom, there you go. You get audio of our baseball podcast here at a podcast to be named later. And if you'd like to follow me, I write at a variety of different websites for a variety of different sports. I write about hockey over at fantasydraft.com. I also write about daily fantasy baseball over there. It's going to start up here in the upcoming weeks for that. If you want to read about fantasy sports, I mostly write about minor league prospects over at rotoexperts.com. So if you want a fantasy perspective on minor league prospects, head on over to rotoexperts.com. I also contribute to baseballamerica.com. I wrote their pitcher rankings for the upcoming fantasy season this year. I also submit some periodical articles. Last year, I wrote for them every single week. This year, I'm going to be reducing my number down there a little bit, but hopefully contributing some articles over there over at baseballamerica.com. Or if you want to read about my baseball conversations and also where we also post these podcasts, you can head on over to minorleagueball.com. It's part of SB Nation. It's minorleagueball.com. We talk about on the podcast. We do recaps of the divisions. We do recaps of the different leagues. American League as well as National League. We just talk about random things. Today we were going to talk about the National League, but we just didn't have time. We talked about exit velocity and pitching and sample size and things like that, and Eno really gets granular when it comes to talking about the subject. So instead of being able to squeeze in some National League recap, all we talked about was the impact and the predictability of exit velocity. And we also talked about pitching and sample sizes. So you can do that in the podcast. We'll also be talking about what we'll be doing divisional recaps every single week. We're going to be doing the National League as well as the American League. We're going to be talking with Brandon C. Williams on Saturday. So if you want to listen to a podcast, we'll be doing it at about 4 o'clock Eastern time over on minorleagueball.com. But if you want to follow me, that's probably the easiest way to do it. It's on Twitter, at CJMitch73. I post links as well as the guests for the programs on Twitter. You can check out my feed or just follow me and get it there. So any links for any of the programs. And we've had some really good guests. I'm not saying that because I want you to listen to the show, though hopefully it works. But we've had some really good guests on this program over the last 3 or 4 weeks, or really over the last few months. So if you're looking to listen to some podcasts that, granted, it's been a month or a couple months since we've had them on. Like, for example, we had Jay Jaffe on 2 weeks ago. We did talk about the upcoming 2016 season, and we are 3 weeks in. But whenever Jay Jaffe talks about baseball, it's relevant whether it was 3 weeks ago or whether it's 3 weeks ago from now. We also talked with him about the Hall of Fame. He's been on the program two or three times already. So we had one show where we talked a lot about the Hall of Fame and some of the changes coming in baseball in general. Then we also did a 2016 preview of the upcoming season with Jay Jaffe. So those two podcasts are both available on my Twitter feed, in the Facebook page, a podcast to be named later, but also over at minorleagueball.com. So if you want to scroll through and find CJ Mitch over there, you'll see that I have podcasts with Jay Jaffe. We've had a multiple of podcasts with Rob Nyer. We've had Jim Callis from MLB Pipeline, a very good prospect guy, one of the best, if not the best in the country, to be honest. He's fantastic. He kind of made his bones over at Baseball America, helped develop that website into the fantastic minor league prospect website in the country, probably the preeminent one. Jim Callis is now over at MLB.com and specifically MLBPipeline.com. He was on the program a couple times this past winter. So if you want to go back and listen to what he had to say about some of the prospects, you don't need for it to be timely. You don't need to have listened to it today. The fact that it's a couple months old doesn't change the fact that it's relevant. Same thing with Rob Nyer. I talked with Rob Nyer about a variety of things. We talked about baseball. We talked about umpires. We talked about pitch framing. We talked about books that he likes and television. So we talked about non-baseball things as well. So we've got a couple podcasts up with Rob Nyer over there. There's lots of topics. George Kurtz, if you want to talk about fantasy sports. Lenny Melnick, the legend. We talk about fantasy sports with him, and we also did some American and National League recaps with those guys. So there are podcasts over there that you don't need to be timely to be relevant and to be interesting. So head on over to minorleagueball.com. You can find it. But probably the best way is to join the Facebook group and start talking baseball with us, a podcast to be named later. Or at the very least, follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73. And if you want me to direct you somewhere or there's something you'd like me to find for you, I'd be more than happy to find you the links and I can send them over to you. Or like I said, head on over to Blog Talk Radio, find a podcast to be named later, and it's part of Bosco Nation. So blogtalkradio.com/Bosco Nation, and you'll find all of our podcasts on there as well. So exciting stuff. Hopefully you're listening in. Hopefully you're enjoying the program. And hopefully you'll be enjoying baseball here in the coming weeks ahead. Again, Saturday afternoon, 4 o'clock, we're going to be talking with Brandon C. Williams about the American League, and we'll do a recap of week number 3 in Major League Baseball. That's all coming tomorrow. Thanks, everybody. Be good, be safe, and enjoy your baseball.